They're coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise name.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Who Shall Ya? I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today, she's sitting to my left, host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast, right here on Max Fun. It's Sometimes It Snows in April. April Wolf, y'all. April, what's good with you?
What's good with me is, I think I mentioned last time that I shot a feminist ghost hunting pilot. We got our sizzle back.
And I think I mentioned that last time.
We got a little bit of money from Fangoria to shoot this pilot in the hopes that, you know, maybe we could sell the show. And we have to make a sizzle, which is essentially like a 3 to 4 minute kind of like supercut of all the cool things to show you what the show is. It was set to music and fun and graphics and blah, blah, blah. But I was so happy about it because I was able to get, and this is a shout out to Karen Tonkson on Pop Rocket too, because I was able to get the Carpenter song Calling Occupants from Interstellar.
Nice.
it's so good. I really love it, and I love the Carpenters, so that made my life worth living.
Can you sing a little bit of that song for us?
Yeah, it's like, what's the words?
Calling occupants from interplanetary craft.
It's interplanetary craft? Yeah.
Yes.
Calling occupants. If you hear it, like,
interplanetary most extraordinary craft.
Yeah,
oh,
it's
word.
So good. But like, it's you got to see that video if you guys haven't seen it before. Look up Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft.
I will talk to that tonight. That's what's up. To my right, film reviews editor at The Wrap, El Mero Mero de Navidad, the one and only Mr. Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what is good with you?
Well, I know you're really excited about the eventual McRib season coming.
Always, son. 24/7, 365.
We got to bide our time. In the meantime, I got to say, the McDonald's barbecue chicken tenders, not bad.
Is that right?
Pretty good.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not as paprika-y as the KFC ones, but the sauce is not bad.
Where can we listen to your McDonald's food review podcast?
I need to start one, just so I can write this all off.
You just shoehorn it into Linoleum Knife.
Well, you know, David,
your
I do have
McDonald's Minute.
If you subscribe to our Patreon on Linoleum Knife, you get our food podcast,
yeah.
Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Yeah,
boom,
yeah.
Son.
And so, I totally talk about crap like this.
My man knows what he's doing. We have a special guest with us on this episode.
Hello.
Hello, sir. How are you? He is a professor, a DJ. That's what's up. Scholar, host of Maximum Fun's Heat Rocks podcast. I'm a fan. I would listen to it on and on to the break of dawn. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Oliver Wong. That's what's up.
How you doing?
How you doing, Oliver? Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. What is good with you?
What is good is I get to guest on this show, which is my very, very slow process of guesting on every Max Fun podcast. I think I'm up to 4 at this point. And somewhere in my future, the Beef and Dairy Network is awaiting my presence, I'm sure.
Yes.
I had a question for you, if I may hijack your what's good.
Oh, shoot.
Alonzo, have you been to, oh, God, I can't remember. It's the butcher counter inside of Grand Central Market, and they serve beef tallow fries like McDonald's used to before they switched over to, I guess, whatever, hydrogenated vegetable oil.
No, but I'm going there right now. Tell me everything.
It has this moment where that first couple of bites, you're like, oh, yes, this is what McDonald's fries used to taste like when I was a child.
Mm.
And then about the 5th or 6th, it's like, this was pretty good, but like I'm good now.
I don't know that you and I have the same like tolerance level for like terrible food.
Oh, no.
It's a different palate.
It's not that it's terrible. It's that I think our memory of how magical the fries there used to be, once you were confronted with the reality of, oh, yes, this is what it tasted like, you're like, oh, yeah, these are good, but not necessarily transcendent.
It's Proust just, doesn't have to eat all the medallions.
There you go.
I hear you.
Thank
yeah.
you very much.
Well, it's like when you have your first Mexican Coke, and you're like, oh, yeah, that burn on my soft palate. That's what Coke used to be before Coke Classic. Right. You
and
know?
You reach the bottom, like, it's still just a Coke, though.
Yeah, ultimately, yes. Yeah. Ricky, what's good?
Oh, damn it. Oh.
I mean,
I feel like he
blazing.
Thought I was going
he
for
did.
It. And he snuck in under the wire.
What's good with me is I found myself kind of like this past weekend, just like doing things that like my dad used to do, like when I was a kid. Like I was like I went to go see. I'm not a big like boxing guy, but when I was a kid, I mean, we just wouldn't get babysitters. So like if my dad was going somewhere, I was going with him, and it was like we're gonna go watch boxing, and you're gonna watch me get shit faced for a little while. So I went and watched the Canelo fight this past weekend, and that was very exciting. And then like my like old like family side world, like just beautifully merged with what I love to do. I was at this party, and they put on, after the fight was over, they put on a documentary and just had music playing. And the documentary was L.A. Plays Itself.
Oh, yeah.
Los Angeles Plays Itself, which I haven't seen. It's been on my Netflix queue. But I just immediately tuned everybody out of this party and was just listening to music and just like all in on this documentary. And I was like, I need to fucking watch this thing.
You
it
do.
Looked amazing. It was so great.
Just be careful not to pick up L.A. Plays Itself because that's actually a gay porn movie.
I own that already on Blu-ray.
Just so
we
know.
Oh, that's a classic, right?
Different shelves, similar titles.
Thank
that's
you.
All I'm saying.
I got the poster hanging above my bed. on today's episode, we are going to be talking about The Predator. We're going to be talking about our favorite problematic films. And as always, we will have our staff picks for you as well. But before we get into all that, it is time for a new segment that we call It a Dick, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Here's how it works. I'll read a news. Actually, we all read news blurbs or headlines now. And anyone can jump in with their hot takes by answering these two questions. Is this important? Do I care? I'll go ahead and start off with the first one here. Back in 2017, one of my favorite actors, Gael Garcia Bernal, was at the Sundance U.S. Dramatic Competition jury and was salty that there weren't as many films from U.S.-born Latino filmmakers at the festival. Now, this was in 2017. Last week, in an interview with IndieWire, Bernal brought up the issue again. He said, and I quote, I would love to mention a good Latino director from the U.S. I would love to give you one name. Like, yeah, man, this guy's doing great stuff, but no, I can't. And I just want to clarify, Bernal is not talking about directors from Latin America. He's talking about Latino directors from the United States. He also goes on to say, quote, this discussion is important for people who are here. There's a whole spectrum of the population that is not shown. Is this important? Do you all care?
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm racking my brain trying to think of one, and I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody that I've forgotten, but I can't think of one either. And, you know, I know there has been an effort from, like, Film Independent here in Los Angeles does a thing called Project Involve, where they aggressively look for minority filmmakers and pair them with mentors and are trying to sort of nurture different voices. Certainly, you know, Outfest does that with Outset. But yeah, we have not seen like a U.S.-born Latino Spike Lee equivalent, for instance.
Right. I think Carlos Lopez Estrada is going to get there. He did Blindspotting. And
oh, okay.
He is a U.S.-born Latino. I believe he's L.A. Born. And or at least Southern California. And the work that he did in that is really exceptional, especially for a first feature. And he also did a TV series that debuted at Sundance this past year. But I think that he's going to be big. And then we also have Reynaldo Marcus Green, who did Monsters and Men. And
what's Monsters and Men? I'm not familiar
It got
with that.
Picked up by Neon. I think it's coming out in a week or two. And it is a drama about, like, a triptych drama about police brutality. And so, you know, one story is from a guy like that guy Orta, who filmed there's a lot of people who've been hurt by police that I'm having a hard time coming up with. This is so depressing. It's so depressing. But he's the one who filmed the murder of the guy who was selling Lucy's.
Right. It's Mr. I Can't Breathe.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he got choked out by the police.
Yeah, so he filmed that, and this is kind of you know, like the story of the kid who filmed it, and then is the only person who has seen any prison time around that.
I mean, I did a quick Google just to double check this. Gregory Nava was born in San Diego.
Okay,
oh,
so
all right,
that's,
there we go.
We got one.
Well,
but he's also going to be 70 next year. So
you know. That's true. Vanessa Arasso over at Remezcla was also just saying, and we'll move on, but. but, you know, her whole thing is trying to expose people to U.S.-born Latino directors. And so definitely, if you don't know those, Bernal, look at Remezcla.
Yeah, totally. And also the name you were thinking of is Eric Garner.
God damn it.
If I can give a quick, very self-serving shout-out, is one of our recent guests on Heat Rocks. In fact, I think our episode with her is going to debut around the same time this episode goes live, which is Aurora Guerrera, who directed Mezquita y Marí, which is set in southeast Los Angeles, Huntington Park. She grew up in the Mission part of the Bay Area, of San Francisco. In fact, I wonder if she knew Jesse back in the day, because he grew up in the Mission. Anyways, so there's another one.
Nice.
That is a great movie, and she's been working on Queen Sugar.
She's been directing Queen Sugar episodes. Yeah,
right. That's what's up. That's what's up. Oh, who wants to take this Natalie Wood story here?
Oh, well, you know, I'm the old one. I'll do it.
Oh yeah.
Breaking news: Captain Dennis Davern is now talking. If you aren't familiar with Captain Davern, he was the yacht captain the night actress Natalie Wood drowned under mysterious circumstances back in 1981. Captain Davern was recently on Dr. Phil. Because, of course, why not? And decided to share his theory on what happened that fateful night. It sounds a little something like this.
So what is your theory?
I think the argument got out of control, and she was knocked unconscious by a physical fight from Robert Wagner and put in the water.
So you believe when you were standing on the back of that boat and he said, don't turn on that searchlight, you were talking to a murderer?
Exactly.
You believe Robert Wagner murdered Natalie Wood?
I really do.
Dr. Phil. Right. For those who don't know, Robert Wagner was married to Natalie Wood from 1972 until her death in 1981. She starred in such films as Rebel Without a Cause and West Side Story, was a legendary Hollywood star. Her death was ruled an accident, but the case was reopened in 2011. Is this important? Do you care?
The heart-to-heart Robert Wagner?
Yes.
I'm looking at I have Google on my phone as well, Alonzo.
Okay.
So I looked it up. And wow. I'm just kind of like in shock. I know nothing about the Natalie Wood story. I know that I know a little bit about the mystery, but I didn't know that she was married to Robert Wagner.
Yes, he was on the boat that night. So was Christopher Walken, with whom she had just made the film Brainstorm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just one of those things where it seems to be a closed case, and then every so often somebody comes forward with some new tidbit of information, and it's like, it's been almost 40 years at this point. It's like, let this woman rest in peace.
Yeah.
Why is he coming out? Like, why now?
What's the motivation here?
Because Dr. Phil has a new season to kick off, I imagine. Just a thought.
You'd have to imagine, though, if the same thing happened now, there's no way this case would have been ruled in
Expediency. Yes. I got you.
That it was back then. And sure. I'm old enough to remember Natalie Wood, her death. Mm-hmm. I was like, nine at the time. But it was a big, big deal given her stature. But again, this is by 1981 standards. Someone of her stature in 2018 drowning, I mean, this is going to be – that would have been tabloid fodder for months and months and months.
And it was then, as I recall.
Was it, though?
I seem to recall it being, discussed quite a bit, a lot of speculation on what was going on. I've heard any number of lunatic theories about it over the years. I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that if you have the goods, why are you now bringing it up all this time later?
Yeah.
Do we know where Ted Cruz's father was during this?
Oh, my.
Now we're asking the right questions.
Where was Ted Cruz, the Zodiac killer? I'll read this next one.
Okay.
So directors Christopher Nolan and Paul Thomas Anderson have joined forces to help make movies look their best on television. Thank you, sirs. In an email sent to members of the Directors Guild of America, they said their plan is to start a dialogue with television manufacturers to ensure optimum screening of movies on TVs. They said, quote, modern televisions have extraordinary technical capabilities, and it is important that we harness these new technologies to ensure that the home viewer sees our work presented as closely as possible to our original creative intentions, end quote. One of the things they hope to tackle is the dreaded motion smoothing feature that flattens backgrounds and makes films look like soap operas, but it's great for live sports if you're going to watch that. And people forget to toggle between the two. So is this important, and do you care?
Hell yeah. I saw this article this week, and I immediately went to my TV settings. I was like, let me make sure that shit is off. When I watch a movie at home, I want it in the best quality. I want it to look as exactly as the director intended it to, or as good as it's supposed to look. I don't want motion. I don't even want like motion censoring like on my TV.
I hope we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater here, because the people who do watch live sports, which I never do, do like motion smoothing and all that stuff. But yeah, on a movie, it looks horrible. I'll never forget going to one of Dave's relatives' houses for Thanksgiving a couple years ago, and Hello Dolly was on TCM, and it looked like it was one of those live network musicals. It was so flat and bright and just horrifying looking.
What I don't understand is, if Ricky can turn it off, and I know it's on my TV and I can turn it off, why is this an issue if you can turn it off?
I think because at the moment the factory setting is that it comes on.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I think maybe what these guys are trying to do is have a setup screen where people can say, oh, this is a thing and I opt out, you know.
And there's also the fact that that option is often buried.
Also, yes.
And not often called motion smoothing. Sometimes it's called something different, and you have to, try to find it. I don't know if they just had, a little button on the TV remote that was just,
the non or off.
Yeah, those already, but yeah, okay.
You know, there's kind of, just a direct motion smoothing button.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing like letterboxing, where people don't necessarily know what it is.
Yes.
And you have to sort of, I always remember Martin Scorsese had that. It was like a 5-minute thing that would pop up on TV where he would explain here's what an image looks like when you chop the sides off, and the yes, you're seeing black bars at the top and the bottom, but that's actually to maintain the ratio, So I think you have to have that kind of thing for people here's where motion smoothing is good and here's where it's bad.
Yeah. That just gave me so many memories of when I worked in Blockbuster, and I would try and get people to rent the letterbox version of a movie. But it chops off the picture. No, it doesn't. It's going to give you more image, and it's going to look beautiful on your TV. It's what it's going to look like when it did in the theater. And then I got fired. That's how that works, y'all. That's how that works.
Oh, shit.
No, I did not get fired.
We have to do an episode about our Blockbuster period, because I worked at one, too.
Oh, yeah, I would totally do that. Absolutely. Hey, y'all, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to be talking about The Predator. You are listening to Who Shot You?
Hi, I'm Biz.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host When Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Whether you are a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent. I don't know how to fix mornings for myself. I do not know how to make mornings okay for myself.
So the T-shirt, I don't do mornings, isn't even a funny shirt. I shouldn't get it for you.
It's sad.
It's a sad shirt.
Yeah, it's a sad shirt with tears flowing.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today are...
April Wolf.
Oliver Wong.
Alonzo Duralde.
Today we are talking about Shane Black's The Predator. Alonzo, please, can you give us a quick synopsis of this film? You love doing it, bro, but you love it, though.
I'd love giving a synopsis of A Simple Favor, which is the movie I want to talk about this week. Okay, so The Predator. There's a predator. Yet another
credits.
Alien big game hunter comes crashing down to Earth in the middle of Boyd Holbrook being an American sniper on some cartel types. He is worried that the army will try and cover it all up, so he grabs some predator tech and mails it to his house and swallows some of it for reasons that are never really explained. The army predictably does try to tell him that he's crazy and puts him in a platoon with other mentally ill soldiers, all of whom suddenly magically get better when they start strapping on weapons and going after an alien, because that fixes everything.
We should do that. We should definitely give everyone weapons.
More arms, absolutely.
Please. Where's my alien technology at?
Meanwhile, the predator tech is found by his son, who has Asperger's, which of course means that he is a super genius, because that's how you do it in the movies, and he can instantly translate alien language and understand what all the doohickeys do. also, then you have Olivia Munn as the like super smart animal scientist who gets called in by the government to figure out what to do with the predator thing. And of course, it gets loose, and there's shooting and explosions, and everything goes haywire. And then the movie has a problem to deal with because of what happened while I was shooting, which we'll get into, which we've talked about, and we'll talk about more momentarily. Yeah. And boom, the predator.
And then it ends.
And then it ends.
And then it ends. It's
like,
weird.
What
it
did
ends.
I just watch? Alonzo, you talked about the controversy on the set of this movie. We talked about it last week's episode. You can go back and listen to that if you want to. But we're just going to talk about it very quickly one more time. April, can you talk a little bit about what happened on the set of the movie?
Sure. I'll be the one who talks about sexual assault.
Again.
I think that's 30 hours of my week at this point. So, Shane Black, writer-director, he hired an old buddy of his that he's hired many times to do kind of a small scene, a bit part, where he would play a guy who's sexually harassing someone.
Olivia Munn.
And, he didn't disclose to anyone involved in the film that this is a man who's on the sexual assault, like the registry. And that he had, you know, been a predator of a 14-year-old girl. And, you know, that's what we know of. Then there was a big backlash about that with Olivia Munn fighting to get that scene removed. And it was removed. And then she continued to speak out about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Did that affect – I'll open this up to everybody now. Did that affect the viewing while you were watching this movie? Did that enter – I would assume it entered all our brains at some point during it, but did it affect how you felt about the movie?
I saw it before all that went down, or at least before it was disclosed to the public. So when I saw the movie, Olivia Munn had not talked to the press about it yet. So it did not impinge upon my viewing, just my viewing impinged upon my viewing. More on that later.
I didn't watch the film differently for it, though I did wonder if the scene that was cut was the scene that also explained how a biologist is so proficient with a whole array of assault weaponry, because she just kind of picks up a rifle and just kind of goes at it. We're like, did we miss something there? Was that left on the cutting room floor perhaps?
I feel like what happened was she wrote that letter when she was 6 years old, like put it in the post, like, you know, sent it in the mail, and then just immediately learned how to do like somersaults and flips,
right,
and could like pick guns up.
Yeah,
we
should back up. The reason that Olivia Munn's character is there as a biologist is because when she was 6 years old, she wrote a letter to the president saying that they should contact her if they ever made contact with aliens. That's the explanation for her.
It's just that easy out there, kids listening to the show. If you want to ever like hang out with aliens, just write a letter to the
snail
president.
Mail to the government.
Yep.
But if we're to look at this film just on its face, it's kind of a mess.
Oh, it's a hot mess.
You know, I admittedly had never seen a Predator movie before. So
okay.
I've missed all of the shitty versus aliens and the original that people love, and 2, which suddenly now everyone's defending, and the Robert Rodriguez one.
People are defending Predator 2?
Suddenly, that's the thing. That's the thing on the internet. Like,
I like the Alien v. Predator.
Is that right?
Really?
Wow. Wait, both of them?
No.
Okay.
Because I always hear those just are the worst.
That's what I've heard as well. I have not watched any of those.
They're ridiculous.
Okay. Is that right?
But that's the thing. When you have a V movie, like Sadako Vikiako, which is like The Ring versus The Grudge, like
right,
those, they're supposed to be fun, dumb
Freddy
versions
versus
of those
Jason.
Movies. Exactly.
Freddy versus Jason is great. I'm a big fan of that one.
Yeah, like they're supposed to be fun, dumb movies.
I hear you. But anyway, this one just felt like, it just felt so jokey, even by Shane Black standards. And I kind of thought, are these movies all this sort of wackadoo?
No, like, not at all.
You know, I did I'm fine with humor in an action movie or in a horror movie even, but like it there's no stakes ever because everybody's just so quippy the whole time.
Yeah, the Dream Team, like Michael Keaton's The Dream Team.
Yes, yes, I was thinking that.
I was just like, oh shit, is this The Dream Team? Like, because I like that movie because it's got that Everybody Walk the Dinosaur song and thing in it. But like, that is not what I thought I was going to get out of a Predator movie.
Yeah, the first Predator. Have you seen the first
Not
Predator
even that
since?
One, no.
The first Predator is a straight up action movie with sci-fi elements in it,
mm-hmm.
Or you could say it's a sci-fi movie with action elements in it. And there's a couple of moments where you kind of like laugh, you know. And I think now we might laugh a little more just because we're familiar with like Schwarzenegger's dialogue, you know, to get to the chopper and all that. But I think a big problem of this movie was that it like leans in very hard and like trying to be funny. And like when sequels do that, the movies that I thought of, like Army of Darkness, I love Evil Dead 2. That's one of my favorite movies. But Army of Darkness really tries to like play up the comedy, and it just sets the tone completely off. Same thing with the Lethal Weapon movies that Shane Black wrote. As those movies go on, they get sillier and sillier. And it's like, that's not what I'm here for.
Oh, yeah, like the Chinese dentist scene with Joe Pesci. Jesus Christ.
Yes.
But that's...
They can't all be gremlins, too.
That's Shane Black. And, you know, for Predator, he wasn't hired as a writer for Predator. He was an actor in that film. And as they were going, the director was like, hey, can you give me a one-line joke? And so he kept doing that. And so they've got like a good like 6-7 one-line jokes in there that he wrote some situations. But, you know, he wasn't doing the entire crafting of it. And and I think that that's where it the fault lay. You know, like you need someone who's good at the crafting of an action film and that story structure. And then, yeah, sure, Shane Black can add some, you know, like weird wry humor that kind of plays against that. But it's still it was just too corny.
It really made me miss John McTiernan. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm not here to defend the jokes in the film, but really the tone of it is the least of this film's problems in terms of what makes it unwatchable. I don't know, I might be the only person who has seen all the Predator films.
Okay.
Which, I'll admit that, I'm fine with that. I can live with that.
Don't be ashamed of that.
This is easily the worst of the bunch, though AVP, Requiem, actually those two tie, and they're both very similar, because they both take place at night, so you can't really see most of the action scenes, which I'm assuming is deliberate because their budget was bad and they can't film in broad daylight. But to your point, Alonzo, this was so narratively incoherent. The plot never made sense. I like coming up with nitpick lists after films I enjoy. And in this case, I did it because I was so angry at all the problems with it. I'm not going
to... another thing.
Right. I'm not going to belabor people with like everything I wrote here. But it was a long list in terms of stuff that made no sense. Just to point out like two or three things. Mm-hmm. One is the part of the plot hinges on the first Predator ejecting from his ship, even though his ship clearly could survive the crash. So it's not clear why he had to eject. But he doesn't eject with all of his gear. And then that gear falls into someone else's hands and that sets off the plot. It's like, why didn't you take off with your helmet and wristband if you're going to – it just doesn't make any sense.
You're right.
Throughout the film, it's just all these moments where it's either complete dumb luck that the plot advances or stuff that has no coherence whatsoever. It wasn't even so bad that it was enjoyable. It was just bad. Mm. And
The review for The Wrap said, the ending of this movie would be embarrassing in fan fiction, but now it's canon!
Oh, that's so sad, you guys. I mean, we didn't even talk about like high-functioning autism as superhero.
Right.
But that's all movies do with autistic kids, is they have to be like Rain Man.
Just like have... You know, autism, and then just also they're just regular characters.
Right.
Are the sniffles a common symptom of being on the spectrum? Because I did not know this. But apparently in the film, if you have the sniffles, then you are autistic.
Thing I learned from Predator.
Yeah. I guess it's like a collection of physical tics maybe or something. Right. But maybe that's just individual to a person. If there are any listeners also who are on the spectrum and who are like interested in that kind of discussion, I would love to hear from how you would view a movie.
But this movie, like you have the kid with Asperger's, but then on the bus of, like you said, the Dream Team soldiers, you have like the guy with Tourette's.
Yes.
The suicidal one, I'm not even sure what the other ones were, but this movie has such a flippant attitude about mental issues and the notion of how to fix them.
Yeah, it's weird. Shane Black says he said he suffers from Tourette's, which is why he wrote that Thomas Jane character, but he wanted to have fun with it. And I was just like,
okay, well.
I mean, honestly, the Tourette's thing is the least offensive because it's like, if you have Tourette's, you're also going to be a regular human who might have a dirty joke, like a dirty sense of mind, like, you know, a sense of humor or, you know, have other facets.
But again, it goes away when he straps on the armor.
That's the thing. Like, it's not consistent. You're right.
And it's also just that I feel like we've seen that same kind of Tourette's in movies where it's, I mean, there's different kinds of Tourette's that people have.
Right.
It's not just that. Fuck cock comes out every 3 seconds. You know, like there's different ways that it
this is the funny Tourette's. This is what Shane Black was going for.
Give me that hot Tourette's I like.
Oy.
There was a minute where I thought, oh man, this is going to be a good movie. this is what.
Wait,
this...
when was this minute? When the credit opening credits? I mean...
Did you have a, do you have a time code for this?
You know, I took that
with the Fox logos on it.
Yeah, it's when the predator is escaping from the science lab. And it's running, like, on top of, like, that scaffolding.
Right.
Olivia Munn is chasing it. And then everybody on the bus is like, let's go get the Predator. I was like, oh, damn, is that what this one is going to be about? Now we are chasing the Predator. And at some point, we're going to feel bad and, like, empathize with the Predator a little bit. That's going to way to flip it.
Oh, man, you wrote a better movie, I think, man.
I mean, that's one of several. I have other ways that I could have improved this movie. I mean, what's his name? Boyd Holbrook? Is he the lead? Sorry, bro, you're not a lead. You're just not.
I mean, he was good in Logan, but I don't know if
he was good in Logan. I don't know if he is not the lead.
Right, right. What was he in Logan?
He was the main, like, protagonist.
He's the guy who's chasing Logan.
Oh, I don't even remember him. Yeah. So that's not a great
good.
Sign.
Okay.
Yeah, he was quite good. I was like, man, just flip the roles, and this could be a little bit more entertaining.
Make him the Predator.
Put Sterling. Put Sterling K. Brown in his role and put Boyd Holbrook in Sterling K. Brown's role. I mean, Sterling K. Brown, when he's not fucking chewing Nicorette, he's chewing all the scenery in the goddamn movie.
And then you've got Yvonne Strahovski from Handmaid's Tale. And this movie all but bends over backwards to make sure that the two women with dialogue in this movie are never within, like, 5 miles of each other. They're never on the screen together.
Which is odd, like, because Olivia Munn's character is in the same house as Boyd Holbrook's wife character. And you're thinking, how come they're not interacting? Does she even realize there's another person in the house? Like, did she come in and say hello?
It's almost like, oh my God, we almost didn't violate the Bechdel rule. Right. Like, keep them apart. Keep them apart.
It's so weird that, like, soldier is also synonymous with man as well.
Whereas, what's her face from Aliens?
Sigourney Weaver?
No, the Hispanic one. Jeanette Gonzalez.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was Vasquez at.
Yeah.
Or is it? No, Jeanette Goldstein. I always get her name wrong. Sorry.
She sells bras for big-breasted women now. I love her.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just imagining, like, if there was, like, a woman soldier who was on the bus, though, it'd have to be like, well, you know, I was raped in combat. Which certainly add some depth to the story, because, like, that's going to be, like, what her, you know, her hang-up is.
I guess their excuse would be that the Army has, like, gender-segregated psychiatric facilities.
That's why you have Olivia Munn able to handle automatic weaponry as if she was born doing it. So they're...
She does look natural, though.
She does.
I thought she was great doing, like, when that happened, I thought that was great. But give us an explanation as to why it's happening. A movie that this made me think of is Annihilation, where also we see Natalie Portman, like, blasting motherfuckers away. But there's a bit of an explanation as to why she can do that. She has a military background.
Right.
And here we just get that Olivia Munn wrote a letter, and I'm like...
It dresses really well for a biologist.
That's what she did.
True.
Olivia Munn wrote a letter.
She wrote a letter. Yo, I got a letter from Olivia Munn. Right,
there's a line in a really cheesy old 70s movie called Food of the Gods where a woman says, jobs for lady bacteriologists are hard to find.
Oh, is that the one with the giant insects? They grow
big rats and stuff. Yes.
Okay. I vaguely remember.
April, sorry.
What?
No, I was excited. I was excited to watch this movie because it's a Predator movie. But then I got more hyped because I just overheard you saying how much you love the Predator series. You're a fan. Where does this one fall? Where does this one fall for you in the canon?
Like dead last.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's just, it tries to be fun and ends up not being fun. And there is, I do like the scene where they're trying to, like, make her feel comfortable when she wakes up so they don't think that they're rapists. Like, mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm just like, you usually had a rapist on set. Weird.
That's what bugs me. Not only does this movie suck, but, like, it's now tainting the entire Shane Black filmography for me. It's like, I already had to sacrifice the ref on the altar of Kevin Spacey. And now are you telling me I can't watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang at Christmas? So, I mean, come on.
So you're out on Shane Black?
It's not looking good right now. Because, again, it's like, as April likes to point out, hiring this guy and putting him in your movies is a workplace safety issue. And putting him in the nice guys where you have a 14-year-old girl starring in the film is extra creepy.
The nice guys already had, like, Yeah. Too flagrant with its tits for 2017. We'll say that.
Yeah, well, and like, it wouldn't it be hilarious if we showed a porn movie to a teen girl, you know? Yeah. But yeah, so it just he's got a lot of dog paddling to do to, like, really kind of justify this situation and do better in the future, or he's on the list.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if we don't hear from him for a minute. I mean, I just...
What? Have you seen? No, of course he's going to get jobs again.
I'm not saying he's not going to get a job. I'm just saying it's, I mean, I don't...
He's probably
don't...
already got like three movies lined up.
You
like,
think
he's,
so?
Yeah, he's going to, like, there's like a pretty quick assembly line of just like, oh, I apologize, get a new movie. Oh, I apologize, get a new movie.
Is anybody watching the new season of BoJack Horseman?
Mm-mm. No.
There's in episode four, there's an award show called The Forgivies. For men who have said or done terrible things that they can then re-enter Hollywood.
Brian Singer is already announced that he's directing Red Sonja next.
So, yeah, great.
So I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying.
A feminist picture about a woman avenging her sexual assault.
Yeah. You know who would be great?
You know who we should get for that?
Oh, my God.
All right, so what do we think, everybody? The Predator. Should people stream it, screen it, or skip it?
Oh, God. Skip it so hard and go see A Simple Favor.
Skip. I like bad movies, and this falls way below whatever barrier that I could determine to be something that anyone would watch in any situation. So, yeah, definitely skip.
Skip.
Yeah. There's things I don't like in my Predator movies. I realize I don't like the city in my Predator movies. This whole thing where, like, the Predator needs to be in another environment. No, the Predator should be in a jungle. I don't like children in my Predator movies. Get your kids out of here. I'm not into that. Predator dogs. Yes, we didn't even talk about the Predator dogs.
Yeah.
Skip this movie, y'all. Damn, skip it.
To paraphrase April's husband, skippermint.
No.
That's what's up, y'all. And we are going to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking about our favorite problematic films.
Hey, this is John Roderick of America.
I know that guy. He also made the theme song for My Brother, and Me. And you've teamed up with your friend Adam and a guy you also know, Ben Harrison.
Hey, you're my friend.
And we make a war movie podcast called Friendly Fire. Now, you may be turned off by the premise right then and there, but you would be wrong.
Well, it's because it's about so much more than war or war films.
War movies are also a great window into filmmaking and the way our culture thinks of itself and other cultures think of themselves.
So listen to Friendly Fire on MaximumFun.org every Friday, or get it wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Who Shall Ya? I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Oliver Wong.
April Wolf.
We just finished talking about Shane Black's The Predator. We did not love that movie, y'all. We did not love that movie. It's hard to talk about that film without mentioning what went on with a convicted sex offender on set. So today we're going to talk about our problematic favorite films that we once loved, but now we just have a complicated relationship with them. It can be a result of the filmmaker behind the movie or the fact that, you know, society's changed. There's, you know, the movie just hasn't aged well. We will each select a problematic favorite film to put in our Who Shot Ya Hall of Shame. Now, who would like to begin on that?
I'll just throw it out there.
Okay.
Every Rainer Werner Fassbinder film.
Oh.
Okay. All right.
Because,
I mean, he's still my favorite director, but, like, dude was a tyrant. Like, destroyed people. And he was
on set in his directing style.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and just around, because, like, all of his movies, they were made with his acting troupe, because he did both theater and film at the same time. So he pulled from the same actors in the troupe, and they got to know each other so well, and he would, like, divide and conquer them. And just to have drama in his life. And he was kind of sadistic at the same time. But his characters of women they're just people that I've gravitated towards. They're very complex and generally not very kind, and I really like that. And they often kind of devolve into insanity, or they hurt people. And you don't often see people making movies like that about women who are, you know, like it's front and center. So I still love them, but at the same time, I understand that they're not quote unquote feminist, you know, like they're not, you know, holding women up to this really amazing light. Of course, that's part of the reason that why I like it, but man, that guy had some complex feelings about women. He was like a totally famous queer kind of pansexual type of man who
was married to a woman.
He was married to a woman, and but he slept with men, and he he was just very very difficult and an interesting person.
Yeah, interesting.
I'm only familiar with one of his movies. It's the it's kind of like a sci-fi movie.
World on a Wire.
World on a Wire.
All right, that was made for German TV. I'll make you a list.
Thank you. I tried watching that, and I fell asleep. And I was like, I don't know if I need to go back to this.
Oh,
I guess I
just
had a different idea of what the sci-fi aspect of it was going to be.
We'll start you with something light, like Berlin Alexanderplatz.
No! What is that, 84 hours?
16? No. Marriage of Maria Braun. That's where you start.
Honestly, that's it's got the, one of the greatest film openings of all time. So you start with Marriage of Maria Braun.
Okay. All right. I will take your word on this. Y'all.
Even though it's like a lot of Nazi talk in that. Yeah. It's just like it's a weird depiction of Nazis. I don't know.
He's a legend, but yeah, he's a lot of things.
Okay.
I had several that I was thinking about, like, you know, like 16 Candles, obviously, has a lot of, you know, questionable stuff. But I'm going to go with the Blake Edwards-directed Peter Sellers vehicle, The Party.
Oh. Okay.
Which is a hilarious sort of Jacques Tati-influenced comedy about an innocent guy who manages to destroy an elaborate Hollywood party and the mansion that it's being held in. It's got some of Peter Sellers' like greatest physical bits and just like odd, you know, quirky timing, and it is in a lot of ways a just sort of brilliant 1960s Hollywood comedy in which Peter Sellers plays the entire role in brownface as a South Asian actor.
Oh.
So, yeah. It's
That's tough.
I don't know what to do with The Party because it's a great movie, but it's, you know, it's wrong. It's all wrong. And so, yeah, it's I can't jettison it, but at the same time, it's like it's, you know, it is a deeply, you know, it is a problematic fave.
When's the last time you watched it?
A couple years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's there are so many great gags and bits and moments in this film, but you just have to deal with the fact that you are watching a white British actor in brownface makeup for the entire duration of the film.
Yeah.
I mean, we just talked about another person who was in brownface. Jeanette Goldstein was in brownface for Aliens.
Yeah. You know, but, like, when I watch, when I see her in that role, though, like, she's just, like, such a badass.
She is badass. She's, like,
yeah, like,
she's like a Latino hero who's, like, not Latina at all.
Yeah, and like, I mean, she was accepted in my household. I was like, dale, Vasquez, así me gusta,
but
you know?
Did Sellers actually darken his face? Are we talking, like, burnt cork style?
Yeah.
Okay, which is a little bit different, I think.
No,
from...
she darkened her face.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, she's, like, she's in the...
Oh, you
she's
just ruined Aliens for me now. God damn it.
It's a great movie. Yeah. It's one of those things that I overlook because it's, like, she's great.
She's great, but she doesn't like come at it with like a heavy over the top accent or anything. It's I feel like it's done very respectfully.
Tastefully.
Yeah,
I know. You know. It's like the most tasteful brown face that I've ever seen. I mean, that's it's. I believe that.
Yeah.
Let's not even get into the Anthony Quinn filmography.
Oh, you know? No.
Oliver, what do you have for us today?
I had a hard time with this. I figured I could try to go with low-hanging fruit like, I don't know, Polanski or Woody Allen, except I don't really love any of those films by either director. The one that I landed on was Bad Boys 2.
Oh,
because cool. I like big, dumb action films, and who does it better than Michael Bay? And this is a film where its problematic level is probably not near 9 or 10. It's more like a 6 or 7, but it certainly does no favors to Haitians. Or to Cubans.
Whoa.
The gratuitous violence level is pretty stunning. Most of the women or the role of women in there is largely to be objectified. So the sort of the redeeming kind of progressive elements to it are quite limiting. But it's really fun to watch. And in terms of, like, it's the one Michael Bay film which it's the sheer over-the-topness of his beosity really works well here at a point at which, you know, they're doing a car chase with a car trailer and they're throwing cars off the trailer on the freeway. And I just remember watching this in the theater and thinking, this is the most absurd thing I've ever seen. Please give me more.
The movie that I have that I watched it again recently, and I can see how it is problematic, but goddamn, I love it, is Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh
boy.
I love Big Trouble in Little China. I defend Big Trouble in Little China. But it is, you know, it is. Well, Alonzo, you had brought up that it plays on this stereotype of like Asian mysticism.
I was not here for this conversation. Actually,
I feel like we've talked about this before. Though. Maybe we talked about it.
I've never seen it, so I
wasn't
have no,
Andrea and Inku were. Talking
I think so.
About
yeah,
that?
I got no take here because I've literally never seen the film.
Oh what? Sorry.
Sorry, I have not seen it. So.
I feel like I'm crazy, or at one point you haven't seen it, but you mentioned to me like the whole like Asian mysticism thing, and I was like, yeah, okay, I can see that. Irregardless,
I don't think that was me.
No? Okay, all right.
As the resident Asian in the room,
yes, sir.
My people generally like the film. Like, I think we've reclaimed it for its campiness,
mm-hmm.
and that it has a very kind of knowing winkingness about the ways in which it plays on those stereotypes. And it still also casts Dennis Dunn in a not leading role, but in a pretty prominent supporting role as a hero figure. Shout out to Dennis Dunn, whose career was kind of began and ended really in a very short amount of time in the 80s. And they still do screenings of it in Little Tokyo, where a lot of my peeps come out to watch it because it has this cult status amongst Asian Americans in particular.
I'm sorry, who's the character actor who's in that and a bunch of John Carpenter stuff?
James
Hong?
James Hong, thank you. James Hong is just like, I don't know, he's had to do a lot of like the same character, but he's also just such a phenomenal actor and he was good friends and is, I think, with John Carpenter. And it's a weird thing that he asked him to be like, can you do like the biggest stereotype of an Asian person? And he's like, yeah, sure, I do it all the time, you know?
Well, it's weird how we then get into sort of issue of like kind of intersectional problematicness, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I've heard you rave about Eddie Murphy movies and other black film critics have talked about like, oh, Beverly Hills Cop and Trading Places. I mean, these movies are such classics. And my go-to thought is super homophobic. You know,
oh, sure. Yeah.
And so and it's kind of like, is it contingent upon me to take your Eddie Murphy pleasure away from you by being the nag about that? You know, so I don't even know half the time, like, where your enjoyment of a like super popular black leading man, you know, who is playing characters that are like running the table and are large and in charge, where that ends and my, I really wish you wouldn't make those AIDS jokes begins.
Oh,
you know?
Totally. I did watch Delirious again, like in the last
month.
Ooh, that is a rough watch.
Yeah.
That is rough. How do we feel though with somebody like Eddie Murphy though, who now when he talks about those is like, yeah, I was in the wrong on that. I was a young, dumb kid who didn't know any better.
No, I get it. People evolve and I don't necessarily hold him personally like anathema, but at the same time, those performances are locked in celluloid forever. You know, him the herpes simplex 12 scene of Beverly Hills Cop is not going anywhere. the scene in Mo Money where they go into the jewelry store and pretend to be a gay couple. I know it's not Eddie Murphy, but like, that's another one of those movies where it's like so totally homophobic and like, you know, like let's throw in some AIDS panic as well. I just like I just think back on those movies and it just makes me cringe.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we've started this wall in our Hall of Shame of every Fassbender film, I'm told.
It's a lot. He was very prolific. Died young, very prolific.
He had a short career, but lots of titles.
The Party, Bad Boys 2, and Big Trouble in Little China.
There you go.
And it has begun, y'all. It has begun. It's almost time for us to go. Before we leave here, we're going to give it our staff picks. Every week we ask the panel to tell us about a movie we think folks should check out, any movie at all streaming in the theater. Oliver, is it all right if I start with you?
Yeah, sure.
What do you got for us?
Well, given that this is the summer of Crazy Rich Asians, which being because I was obligated by race to have to go see it and support it, which I quite enjoyed. But anytime I get to talk about Asian American film, and this is something I used to teach as an instructor, I got to plug the greatest Asian American film ever made, which is the first one, the first feature film, Wayne Wang's 1982 Chan is Missing, which, and I don't know what it means that the first film is still the best one because no one's managed to surpass it, but I stand by this, that I'm still hoping that someone will make a better film and no one has yet. And it's not an easy film for a lot of folks to watch because it's in black and white and people hate watching black and white, but it's so smart, and especially in terms of how it tries to tackle issues about race, ethnicity, and community, but not do it hella didactically or pedantically, is part of what makes it so genius. And it's something that every time I watch it, I just marvel at how Wayne Wang just knocked it out of the park on his first major feature film.
Warren, that's what's up. Thank you. Alonzo?
I hope I'm not stealing April's on this one, because
we'll see. I've got a backup just in case.
This is a movie about women with agency who murder people. Lizzie, opening wide this weekend, Chloe Sevigny plays the infamous Lizzie Borden, and with Kristen Stewart as her Irish maid, who this film speculates that the two of them were lovers, which is not a new idea. Ed McNeil did it in a novel. Ed McBain, rather, did it in a novel back in the 80s or 90s. But this movie is so sort of fraught with kind of this palpable eroticism between the two of them and this notion of just women stuck in a crap situation and lacking agency, and this is what they are driven to do by the men around them. I saw this movie at Sundance this year and just loved it. It's one of my favorite films this year, and those two performances are so great. A deep bench of great character actors, you know, Dennis O'Hare, Jamie Sheridan, Fiona Shaw, Kim Dickens. And it's just, it's so smart, and it's a movie you find yourself like you're catching your breath, just sort of wondering how this is going to go, even though you know where it's going to go. I love this movie a lot. Go see Lizzie.
That's what's up, yo. This weekend, my girlfriend and I were watching TV, and a trailer for that came on, and one of your quotes came up on the screen,
nice.
And
nice.
We both shrieked. We're like, Lotso! It was awesome.
The new phone books are here. I'm somebody now.
All right.
April, what do you got?
Okay, I've got two quick ones. One is a joke, because you have to see Life Itself. It comes out.
Yes.
Comes out this
shit.
Friday, and it is fucking insane. It, like, not a bit of it makes any sense. It is like treacly to the max. It's like this year is Collateral Beauty meets Crash.
Ooh.
It is just like intersecting,
you're talking my language,
intersecting lives that all have dumb tragedies. Like the dumbest tragedies. It's supposed to make you cry, as Emma Stefanski, another critic, said, it's the only movie where I cried when a dog died. It's true. Really ridiculous. What's up?
You want us to actually go watch this?
Well, here's the deal. If you don't want to think and you just want to laugh in a theater where other people might be crying,
yes.
You know?
Oh, I do like that.
Yes.
Okay, sold.
Big fan.
I'm sorry, I'm an asshole. The
oh, yeah,
real
April
one.
I like to go to funerals and go, your tragedy's stupid.
So the one that's a real one, though, is you guys got to see Mandy. It's Panos Cosmatos' new film, co-written by Aaron Stewart Ahn, and it is just a really fantastic adventure through the most metal movie that you can imagine. And Andrea Riseborough is a fucking goddess in this movie. She's so good. She plays like this, like, very demure, like, not demure. She's just like a very kind of quiet, inward metal woman. I love her. She's like an artist. And then Nick Cage gives a remarkably restrained performance. Like, No, it's true. It's actually true. If you watch the movie, I mean, you might see like the highlights, and you might grasp onto the highlights of him being like, oh, I'm Nick Cage, and he's like emoting. But for so much of it, he's just kind of a grief-stricken dude who's just trying to grapple with you know, what's happened in his life. It's fantastic. It is like a visual feast.
Okay.
I hated it, but I'm in the minority. So
every day this week, people have been coming into work saying either I need to see Mandy or I just saw Mandy. Holy shit. So I'm very excited to watch
this
movie.
It twice, and I was on the fence on the first one. And then on the second viewing, I was just like, oh, shit. Okay. I am on board and I get this.
That picture of him, I think it's at the premiere where he's wearing a gold like bomber jacket and like red sunglasses. I'm like, Nick Cage is my motherfucking man. That's my guy.
Somebody said Nick Cage dresses like you're cycling through how you're going to dress your Tekken character.
I saw somebody say Nick Cage dresses like what cocaine looks like. I talked about Big Trouble in Little China. I've been doing a John Carpenter deep dive, just going back and watching his movies. And the last one, I think I'm done for a minute, but I just went back and watched The Thing again, which I think goes very well with this episode of watching The Predator. I mean, just it's watching The Thing and then seeing The Predator, like you could just see all the mistakes that movie made. I mean, we didn't even talk like about how fucking kind of like masculine the Predator is. And I feel like The Thing is as well, but just in kind of like a different kind of way where it's not like, oh, we're like badass dudes and we're going to get through this situation. It's just more kind of like there's ego involved and nobody's trusting each other. And just kind of like the paranoia that starts to build in after that and the insecurities that start to build in after that. Kurt Russell, I mean, one of the best Halloween costumes you can ever have out there, y'all, is MacReady with the blowtorch and those goggles. Or Pre-Pharrell with the Pre-Pharrell big-ass hat while he's flying the helicopter. It's so great. Check out The Thing, y'all. John Carpenter's a thing. It's fucking amazing. Hey, shout-out to everybody who has been leaving us 5-star reviews on iTunes. We greatly appreciate that. If you leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts, we will read that review on the show. We got one right here from Gene David. They say, I want Ricky Carmona to be my personal hype man. Gene David, I'm your boy! I want April Wolf to be my drinking buddy. I want Alonzo Duralde to be my dinner party guest. Hashtag chocolate to peanut butter ratio. I want Jerea Clark to program my weekend entertainment. I want Ingu Kang to be my life coach. Shout out to Casey O'Brien. That's what's up. Look at Casey getting that love. Oliver, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
I want
You're
you to
know. Classing up the joint.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
I loved the episode you had where you had, I can't remember what the name of the guest was, but you all broke down 3 Feet High and Rising.
Thomas Gulbich, who's the music supervisor on Breaking Bad and now does Better Call Saul, and he was fantastic.
Yeah, that was a great episode, great show.
Thank you.
If everybody out there who doesn't listen to Heat Rocks, please get on that, listen to that show. Oliver, is there anything you want to plug? Where can the people find you? Where do you DJ at, man? I DJ. We haven't even had this conversation, son.
We'll have to pair up at some point.
Okay.
I don't have any regular gigs. I might be coming back to college radio, which is how I got started for 10 years when I was living up in the Bay Area. People can find me on Twitter at Oliver S. Wong. That's W-A-N-G. I'm on Instagram at SoulSides, which was or is the audio blog that I started back in 04, which I kind of still vaguely keep up with. And, of course, people should really tune into Heat Rocks if you're not already doing so.
100%.
Oh, and if y'all DJ together, then it'll be a versus situation, which April says is stupid.
RVO. Requiem.
RVO, it's happening, dog. It's happening. Next week, we will be talking about the Sisters Brothers with Ingu Kang. She will be back in the building. We have a hotline, y'all. We have a shot line. You can call us. Before we were asking questions about the movies, now we are just kind of opening it up to y'all. If you want to call and just ask us a question, leave a comment about the show, go ahead and do that, y'all. The number is WSY-803-1664. Again, that's WSY-803-1664. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, you can always tweet us at WhoShotYaPod. You can send us an email at WhoShotYaMaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. It was very good to see all of y'all. It was very good to see all
always
y'all.
Always a pleasure,
very
sir.
Good to see all of y'all.
Bye.
That's what's up. That's what's up. This is a production of MaximumFun.org, and that is what is up.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.